You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. Joining me, Aaron Brown from Minnesota Brown from Strong Towns. Chuck Marone. Chuck's our conservative.
What?
What? Don't say it.
Our conservative commentator, and Aaron is our liberal commentator. And we're continuing the conversation. See, I was muckraking there.
Start discrediting me amongst my, you know, that's the thing is that once you establish that beachhead, you start to mess with people's mind and you lose your credibility, right, Aaron?
I mean, that's right.
If people said, oh, Chuck, he's a liberal, then, oh, bam, I have no tribe anymore.
No, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go when you go to the leather-bound clubs of,
right, exactly,
of your conservative hangouts?
Exactly.
I presume.
They'll start to suspect me. And with Aaron, you know, if you don't follow the party line, then you get kicked out of the tribe. They don't invite you to the parties anymore.
That's right. That actually happened a while ago.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Just being here with you, Aaron, discredits me.
Yeah. Yes.
So let's talk more about journalism. That's what we're digging deep into today. You talked about the number of newspapers. When did things start to change where now we're seeing that towns don't even have their own papers, or if there is a paper in your town, it is not owned locally, and tons of constraints on what can happen at that newspaper, let alone moving into radio, TV, and all that.
Yeah. So. You know, I came out of this thing. I grew up on the Iron Range in media. I had a really unique and wonderful experience when I was in high school. I got a job. Every kid has a part-time job. My part-time job was as a radio disc jockey, and I was training to be a journalist. From a very young age, wanted to be a journalist. I was writing freelance for the newspaper, covering sports here and there, and working as a radio announcer. I was developing a legitimate little resume there, even in high school. And being a print journalist or a radio journalist was a legitimate option in the 1990s. I like to say I was the last non-ironic journalism major in the country. I was from a group that thought that like a working class kid could just go do this job and it wouldn't have to involve a lot of money to get into special programs to get the access that you would need to be a journalist. It was just, you could do this just by asking questions and learning how to do the job. And that there would be a place that would hire you. Your local paper, at least, is an option for you. And so I went through college and got to be a journalist. And my very big dream job was to be editor of the Hibbing Daily Tribune, which was the paper where I lived in Cherry, and got hired there. My wife at the time had just gotten married, and my wife worked there and had just left. And I got a job. I essentially got her job as reporter. And within 6 months, the editor left. It was the fourth or fifth editor who had left within the last 2 or 3 years because of changes in the industry, I guess I would say it. Because I was of the generation that was on computers or could use computers, and they were moving to an all-digital layout of the paper, pagination, digital pagination, desktop publishing, I was the only one on staff at the time who knew how to do it. So I was 21 years old, and I was made editor of the Hibbing Daily Tribune.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
You know how to run a computer.
And
you
know how to run the place. They literally offered the job to two people before me, and they didn't want to come to Hibbing to do it. And so here I was, hungry to do it, and this boy editor is now running the newsroom of this small-town newspaper. Now, one of the things I figured out pretty quickly, now I'm a middle manager because I'm not in charge. I'm not the old publisher editor of the old days, you know, where it's me and my printing press and my opinions. I am a part of a large organization that is dedicated to excellence and especially our stockholders. And so,
and those two things aren't always the same thing.
Well, they are always the same thing, Chuck. Haven't you been to the meeting? Didn't you get the memo? You can be excellent and make money for your stockholders. Of course you can. Uh-huh. And of course, the reality is not always, because what would be excellent for a community is having coverage of local events and reliable relaying of important information that families or kids or people need to know for school, for work, for everything else, and to have enterprising stories that get to the bottom of how the government's spending our money and how projects are taking place and what our elected officials are up to. And all of these things require people to do the work to find out. which is really the value of journalism, is finding out what's going on. It's the only value of journalism. Of course, when you make these newspapers, they always were profitable. They always were businesses. And selling advertising has always been controversial within newspapers, because who buys your advertising is considered a form of bias and all this. But we had come out of this time when, you know, journalism was supposed to be cleaning up its act and not be biased. And there was a wall, a solid wall between advertising and editorial content. But the reality was that wall always had a whole lot of holes in it. And the bias of the messaging about how newspapers could survive all of this corporate kind of influence was that really it was impossible to do journalism in the classic person-to-person way anymore because of the technological problems. I was this desktop publishing guy, and one of my main things that I did as editor was oversee the elimination of the composition department, which was a cost-saving measure. So these people who used to work there and be professionals are now gone. The newsroom shrank in size from the time I entered to the time I left, and there were fewer writers, and more of the writers' time was now being spent doing digital versions of the job that old composition department used to do. The actual laying out of the paper, the people who would, in the old days, would have set the press with the little letters, or later on used the lead to create plates and then print the tape and all these different technological advances in the industry. Well, now it was being done by the reporter or reporter editor who was doing the writing and investigating as well. And it's all this consolidation in the job, this automation essentially was part of it. But the ownership structure also changed. And I think this is, for small towns, the biggest difference in the media right now. 80 years ago, 60 years ago, you had a radio station in your town. You were doing pretty good. The radio station was owned by a person who owned that radio station, and they lived in your town. For a while, that was an actual requirement of some of your FCC licensing. They wanted local ownership of the local station. The newspaper was owned by a publisher who lived in your town, probably attended civic organizations, went to church with so-and-so and so-and-so. Everybody knew who that person was. They walked the street. Maybe you disagree with them. Maybe they run a rag or a terrible radio station or you know, whatever, but they were a local person, and communities were shaped by the way that their local newspapers and media outlets interacted with their schools and their places of worship and their civic organizations and their government. And it was all kind of a communal, not a communal thing, but certainly a community, in that what one did affected the other, and they learned that. You know, and they learned how their actions affected each other. When it became evident that these newspapers and radio stations made a lot of money, and they made a lot of money, really. Once they got their systems all consolidated, once there was only one small town newspaper, and it was just them that were the only way that the car dealers could sell their cars, and it was the only way that the various merchants could sell their wares, and the only place where you could sell your old truck or your barely worn boots or whatever. And that was the only place to go. Well, these newspapers were making lots of money. And people figured this out. Like, hey, what? Why have one of these that makes me a fairly well-to-do, upper-middle-class citizen in my town? What if I bought another one? And what if I bought a third one? And what if I'm making millions now and I bought as many as I could? And so what happened is all these small-town papers get gradually bought up by bigger and bigger companies, and soon these national chains of newspapers are forming. Ideally, they'd all be making money, but as this trend continued, the idea of debt leverage started coming into this, because how am I going to buy 50 newspapers if I'm only making a little bit off the 5 or 6 newspapers I have? Well, I'm going to borrow the money. Which means that now I not only need the profit margins that the paper used to deliver, but I need a little bit of extra money for the debt service, which means I need to twist and squeeze all those properties I own to reduce staffing, to reduce cost. Essentially, staffing is cost. So if I lay off people and people still buy the newspaper anyway, even though I laid off all these people.
Because there's no other alternative.
Right, because again, in a small town, the newspaper is the newspaper. So the fact that they don't do as well covering local sports, or that they don't seem to truly understand everything that's going on in the city government anymore, that's secondary if people have to buy their product. Well, in a nutshell, and for radio and newspaper, how all these small town consolidations took place, which is why, with a few exceptions, notable that we might talk about later. If you're in a small town here in northern Minnesota or anywhere else, you're listening to probably a fairly homogenated commercial radio product. You're looking at a newspaper with a much smaller staff than they used to have, either running wire copy or, you know, and I say a small town, like a small town weekly that's still locally owned is probably not terribly different than it was maybe 30, 40 years ago. But a lot of these newspapers that are corporate owned, you see a lot more shared content, content coming from different towns. Maybe it has value. Maybe it's just there because they need something and their sister newspaper was producing it, so they use it there.
That's Aaron Brown. He's our liberal commentator for Dig Deep. We're talking journalism today. Chuck Maroon's our conservative commentator. He talks more now about consolidation of media in small towns.
I think at the same time that you were seeing this kind of debt-levered consolidation that Aaron talks about, you had this other phenomenon that was going on, which is the cash cow revenue streams that local newspapers had that made them so wealthy went away. Mm-hmm. Classifieds were a huge deal.
They were the biggest.
It was like half or more of the revenue came from classifieds. You wanted to sell your car, you gave the newspaper 50, 60 bucks to do that. I mean, you gave them a lot of money to run your classified. You wanted to hire someone, it cost you a lot of money to place that ad. You look and they would have pages and pages and mm-hmm. pages of classifieds. Now you go to Craigslist, there are all these, you know, eBay, there are all these places that are just selling stuff all the time with very low margins. Great for consumers, not great for the newspaper model. The advertising is another one. The auto dealerships used to have to run. If you wanted to be a player in that game, you had to run a full page ad in the newspaper. That was big money you were putting down. You were transferring that to the newspaper every week to get your full page ad in front of people. Dayton's, remember the old Dayton's ads? They used to have like 2-3 pages on a Sunday. These massive, massive, huge ads. That was their deal. That market has completely changed now. And if you're a newspaper, you're not making much margin off of Google placing a banner ad on your site. You're just not. You don't have the traffic volume to make that pay. And so all of a sudden, what you see is that the efficiency model that we tend to herald in the free market capitalist system as being like the solution starts to not work for local journalism. We can consolidate 5 newspapers into one. We can close all of their printing presses and get one giant press somewhere and send all the stuff out to that. But now all of a sudden our deadline has moved mm-hmm. up 3 hours because we got to meet the press deadline. So we can't get the information about last night's meeting into it. So now all of a sudden you're getting the news on 48 hour delay now. So the quality of everything starts to drop and people notice. I'm from Brainerd. I have a soft spot for my local newspaper. I'm bewildered when I open it up and I'm getting news from Fargo and Devil's Lake because they've been bought out by the Fargo Forum and that whole paper and draws their news that way. All of a sudden, instead of being a paper that looks south towards Minneapolis and St. Paul, which I think is a natural relationship for the Brainerd region, we now all of a sudden look north and west towards Fargo as like the center of our communications hub. And it's a little bewildering. So you have these kind of efficiencies that have changed local newspapers, and I don't think it can be undone. I actually feel like this is a dying model, and I think in the next segment we're going to talk about what comes next. But you start to see places like, and I'll give a pitch for us right here, you start to see places like KAXE that can actually do storytelling at a local level. You see, you know, the rise of local blogs and just individuals writing about stuff. The quality is not there. The journalistic integrity is not there, but you're getting it quicker. You're getting it
not
deeper.
Always.
Not always. Yeah. But you're getting that kind of stuff. I do think also just one other point about this consolidation. One of the things that we fret about today, if you go back to the 80s and listen to politicians, they would tell you all politics is local. And that's because all politics was local. There was a local narrative going on that dominated the conversation. Yeah, there were things going on in Washington. There were things going on in the state capitol. But the big thing in your paper was going to be the local thing. Today, it's inverse. All politics is not local. All mm-hmm. politics now is national because your newspaper is running stuff from AP. It's running stuff from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. It is all in the context of what the national narrative is. And the best you can hope to do at the local level is kind of localize the national narrative. And that, again, is bewildering to people because it forces us into a black or a white, a left or a right paradigm. And it doesn't create that kind of local nuanced conversation that really, I think, is the hallmark of great American discourse.
So what does it do to a town if you no longer have these kind of papers that is relevant to the life in that town?
I think a town has to be self-aware to know what it is to function.
To me, it's disorienting.
Yeah, it has no orient. It doesn't know what it is. If people in a town don't know that they're a town, if they don't know that these houses around them are part of a larger structure and that there's industry, there's an economy, there's a culture, there are people doing things right in your midst, you think you're alone. People individually feel alone in their towns because the latest crisis on the national news is the only thing that they know. They don't know that you can go out and take in a show at the local school, or that the church is having a corn feed, or any of these things, because that doesn't exist. It's really just this, there's something big and scary in the world, and it's always, always coming to get you.
Well, and let me give this a real, like, specific local context, because a couple shows ago, we talked about schools. Right now in Brainerd, we're having a conversation about capital improvements, hundreds of millions of dollars, a bond referendum. I look through here, and a lot of it, the reporting is basically the horse race reporting. Like, here's what happened at the school board meeting. Here's what they're proposing to do. It's all, like, current. And what we lack is we lack, like, the deep understory. Why do we have four schools that we closed? What happened in the 80s when we did a bond referendum to build an art center at the high school that's now part of the current bonding, you know, request? There are all these other nuanced stories that require journalists to have time to dig into things, to have established long working histories in a community, to actually have the deep roots to understand what's going on and who to call and where to cull these stories. Because of that focus on efficiency, and because that cash cow thing is gone and we really don't have the capacity anymore to do that type of journalism, what you're getting is stuff that's really superficial. And to me, the disorienting nature of it, I think people might say we become this instant social media generation. We have, but that's not by choice. It's what's been like thrust upon us. There is no alternative to that anymore.
Yeah, I was just thinking of a story when I was at the newspaper. I remember an election night, a local election night, and Chuck was saying how the old saying was all politics is local, but that's not the case anymore. And I remember covering a city election. It was an election night, and I was with the longtime city clerk who was in a tough race for re-election, and it had been a year where there had been a lot of flooding from bad sewers in the town, and this was the local issue.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a close race. There was a couple precincts left, and I was with him. He was looking at the precinct map, and they said which ones were still out, and he said, I lost. What do you mean you lost? I said, that's where the sewers backed up, and I'm the incumbent.
Right. Right.
And he knew. So there was this, and I am the reporter kind of getting that perspective from him on how an issue, it was a local issue. Now I'm watching the more recent, just the last few years, that was the early 2000s. Now it's 15 to 17 years after that. And I'm watching like local coverage of the special election in Itasca County or some of these things. And newspapers barely ask any questions. The candidates offer platitudes that have more to do with the office of a state legislator or a member of Congress than they do a county commissioner. And the voters make their decision really, frankly, based on their partisan index. You know,
if you're a active media consumer today trying to get informed, you actually know more about some precincts in Ohio that CNN thinks are important than a precinct in Itasca County that actually affects you more. And that is that's a tragedy, really.
You know what I think is interesting is, Chuck, as you were talking about what happens to a town when you don't have these kind of papers, and you were both saying it's disorienting, there isn't that history. You guys are the kind of the modern day journalists. You're both bloggers, podcasters, and you have the history. Every time we do these conversations, we start with history and we learn about where you came from, the land where you came from, and then we move into current times. And so that is there.
Let's talk about that in the next segment, because I'm actually more optimistic on the future of journalism and news coverage. I think there's a lot of hope but it's going to require a change and transition.
Okay. That's Chuck Morone, a conservative commentator, Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator. It's Dig Deep. In our next segment, we'll talk more about the future of journalism and how Chuck and Aaron consume media.